From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, as the population of Texas is graying, why state lawmakers need to pay attention to the nursing home crisis. Get out that bucket list. There are 100 things to do in Texas before you die. And why the word of the year is toxic. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The largest nursing home provider in Texas filed for bankruptcy this week. Senior Care Centers filed for Chapter 11 protection. The Dallas-based company operates about 100 facilities in Texas and reported more than $100 million in debt. In a release, the company pledged that patient care will not suffer due to its financial woes. However, the Texas Healthcare Association, an advocacy group for the long-term care industry, said this bankruptcy sends a signal that their industry, that many elderly Texans depend on, is in serious trouble. And because of the rapidly aging population of Texas and the reluctance of the state lawmakers to raise the Medicaid reimbursement rate, the situation is getting much dire. Kevin Warren is the president and CEO of the Texas Healthcare Association.
It's extremely disconcerting that you had a company this size whose day in and day out responsibility is to care for people's loved ones across the state, and it's the largest company in the state of Texas having to file for bankruptcy, and people should be concerned about it, should be worried about it, because it is absolutely a clear warning that the state's nursing home funding levels are woefully inadequate. So far this year, we've already seen a not-for-profit facility in San Antonio that had been caring for our state's elderly for over 40 years that closed its doors due to Medicaid reimbursement. Earlier this summer, we saw one of the largest long-term care companies in the country leave the state of Texas because it can no longer operate here because of the financial situations. And now we see the largest company that operates in the state of Texas that's filing for bankruptcy. And the problem is not going to go away, and we have got to address this Medicaid issue before what is a crisis continues to grow.
The reimbursement rate as it stands today, what are the problems?
So the reimbursement rate for the state of Texas is either at or near the bottom when compared to all other states. And when you look at the fact that the men and women that are cared for, mothers and grandmothers, fathers and grandfathers, are taken care of, they are taken care of on a 24-hour period on an average. The average Medicaid rate is an average of paying about $6 an hour. To care for them, and that includes meals, that includes daily care activities, social services. It's caring for all of their needs 24 hours a day, and we're currently paying an average of $6 an hour to accomplish that task.
So we saw with the bankruptcy declaration by Senior Care Centers, they're $100 million in the red. Many of the people that they care for, you need Medicaid in order to pay the bills, but the money's not there. They just can't make it work.
Right. So if you look statewide, approximately two-thirds of the residents that are living in nursing homes in Texas, their care is paid for by Medicaid. And according to the most recent data, the Medicaid rate is paying at approximately $27 a day less than what it costs to care for those residents. So if you look at this dollar amount and the two-thirds of the residents, so you're roughly, I want to say it's about 55,000 residents across the state, that their care, that the state of Texas is paying less for their care than actually cost to provide it. This compounding effect occurs, and then you get into situations where they're doing the best they can, but at some point they can only give so much, and unfortunately I think you see what you saw yesterday.
So where is this leading? If the numbers aren't there, if the reimbursement rate isn't improved, who's going to go into the business of providing these services when you don't make any money?
Well, and that's the challenge. That's the challenge because, you've got this industry and these men and women rely on on folks to provide care for them, and it's the hands-on care every single day. And so when you have such a low Medicaid reimbursement that is responsible for so much of the care, what you get is it makes it extremely difficult to compete in the labor market. It makes it extremely difficult to invest in the necessary capital improvements and invest in innovation and technology to do all those things to advance the care of men and women, of people's loved ones that are, by the time they get to a skilled nursing facility, they're much sicker and require much more care. And like I said, this inadequate Medicaid rate is a significant part of the problem in being able to address and manage their care adequately.
This is also a big employer for many parts of Texas. What's going to happen to those folks?
It's a huge employer, and in fact, in many of the many of the rural markets, they are typically your nursing facilities are typically one of the largest employers, next to the government, local districts, and school districts, and so that's what you just said. That's the fear. That's the uncertainty, and where the anxiety comes is what does happen, and will those, and we're not just talking about the situation from yesterday. We're talking about, anytime providers are looking at whether it's bankruptcy or selling because they can no longer meet the needs of the residents because of the financial situations they're placed in, is the facility going to have to close? Are those residents going to be displaced and have to move? Is it going to cause job loss in local economies that are relying, on that business to provide those local jobs? It just creates a host of questions and issues and uncertainty.
Even in areas of Texas, all over Texas, we're seeing record low unemployment. People have a lot of choices of where they want to go work. And working in a nursing home, it requires a full commitment, and people could go get paid elsewhere doing something not as intense.
That's one of the most difficult parts when you look, the difficult issues to when you look at that is, like you said, because of other parts of our state's economy and how well it's doing, and you see that we have such a low unemployment rate, that means, in essence, that those that want to work, they are working. They have found job security, which makes it that much more difficult for facilities to compete in those labor markets. And that's, that's part of the problem. The other problem, David, I would add, is that when you look at the demographics, this problem isn't going to go away. In fact, I would argue, and the data would argue, that it's only going to get worse when you look at how our population is aging, when you look at the fact that the caregivers that are caring for their loved ones at home, they're aging and they can no longer provide that care, and so they've got to look to somebody else to step in to help them. The need and demand is only going to continue to grow. And, like I say, if what happened yesterday and everything else and the other, the closures, the departures from the state, if that's not a wake-up call, then I fear what we're waiting on in order to make the necessary steps to ensure that we've got adequate Medicaid funding for these men and women.
What about the quality of care? That's part of this as well. I mean, if you are nickel and diming these nursing homes, what does that mean to the people who rely on them?
So what the challenge will be there is that the men and women that work in these nursing homes, and you said it, they work extremely hard, and they are committed to their jobs each and every day. And I mean, I've been able to work side by side with these folks, and I am amazed at the level of effort that they put in for those that I would say, for those that they are caring for. But when you have challenges with workforce turnover, then you have potential issues with continuity of care, where you may have a new staff member that's taking care of a resident, doesn't know all their wants and needs. And so when you look at the importance of funding for staffing, it creates the potential concern for the quality of care is going to suffer.
As you say, this problem is just going to be getting worse because of the demographics that we have in Texas. Texas has an aging population, particularly in certain areas. We have counties where there's a significant proportion of the population that is over 65. Are we thinking about that and preparing for that?
Well, I can tell you we're thinking about it. My concern is that we're not preparing adequately for it. I mean, as you said, if you look according to the Texas Demographic Center, The population in Texas over 65 is projected to grow from 2010 to 2050 by 262%. At the same time, in those communities where you have that type of growth in the older populations, you also have to ensure that you have the necessary and available workforce to care for that population as they continue to age. Or else we're going to have to, or else they're going to have to move further away from what they know as home in order to receive the care that they need.
So the legislature, they get started again in January. Is this something that you think they will take up?
This is something that we are going to be working with them on. And this is our number one priority, is to address this funding issue, because we as a state are much better than this. We expect more from each other. We expect more, from our state. And so this is a priority for us to ensure that we have a plan and work together with our state legislature on a solution that allows us to invest in our nursing home infrastructure, invest in those processes that will improve patient care, and at the same time be able to invest and reward those providers who are meeting and exceeding those quality of care expectations.
What if we don't?
If we don't, then my concern is that the plan B or what you're going to see is you're going to see more closures. You're going to see more companies leave. There are companies today that are looking at their 2019 business decisions based upon what comes in this upcoming legislative session.
So if I got to deal with an aging parent, I can no longer care for this aging parent. I need to find a nursing home that I have faith in. I don't have any money. My parent doesn't have any money. They're going to have to go be dependent on Medicaid, and we're going to find no options, no takers.
It's difficult to say. David, I just don't know. But I know that I feel confident in telling you that if we don't do something this session, the landscape we know today of long-term care and our ability to provide care like we do and where we do across the state will not be the same. And that's very concerning.
Kevin Warren is the president and CEO of the Texas Healthcare Association. After the bankruptcy announcement this week by the state's largest provider of nursing home care, he is warning that the state needs to address the needs of the industry. Many of us take pride in Texas, but how many of the state's wonders can we say that we've enjoyed firsthand? Author and historian E.R. Bills says that he can because he's written a book. And that book is 100 Things to Do in Texas Before You Die.
Some of them are easy, like eating Tex-Mex and eating a chicken fried steak. I mean, things like that are pretty easy. I list some restaurants that would be good places to visit to do those things, but the tougher things like trying to do the Hotter Than Hell 100 in Wichita Falls, that's probably a little tougher, and you better try it when you're young. But things like the Devil's River, it's just a pristine resource here in Texas. It's an amazing place to visit, but nobody goes.
I noticed that you do have to have a level of physical fitness to do some of these items.
Yes, some of them. Well, like I said, the Hotter Than Hell 100 chiefly. And then, of course, the Texas River Safari that starts in San Marcos, it goes all the way to the ocean, the canoe or kayak trip. But a lot of the stuff, like I mentioned going to Big Bend, experience Big Bend. Well, everybody can't do the South Rim hike, but there are shorter, easier hikes to do. And then the drive through the park is amazing. You don't have to do all of it, but just experiencing Big Bend is something everybody should do, in my opinion.
But it helps to know that these things do exist, even if you don't do them yourself.
Right. There's some history in the book. I give some background on some of the things you can do. Like, well, obviously everybody knows about the Alamo. Visiting a place like the Spanish Fort, and I'm sure a lot of people know about the Johnson Space Center, but very few people know or have heard of the Seminole Canyon State Park down there, I guess, north of Del Rio. They've got 4,000 and 5,000-year-old Indian pictographs, some of the oldest art in North America there. And it's fantastic. It's a short little hike, and it's an amazing thing to visit and see, but just very few people do it. When you think of those things, you don't think of them in terms of Texas. People have gone and seen stuff like that in Arizona or Utah, but we have some of it here. And and getting out and going to see it. I think it's kind of important.
There are many items in the book that the clock is ticking on, and you say they're not always going to be here to experience. And one of them is that comes to mind is what's happening with the Balmoray State Park and the San Solomon Springs, and how that those pool that existed for so long and now it's in trouble.
Yeah, you know, the fracking around the area, they're saying, had something to do with cracking some of the casing or some of the containment limestone or whatever around the pool there. And so it's affected San Solomon Springs and Balmoray. And that's crazy because it's a real treasure. It's one of the neatest things to do in Texas. And I listed on, you know, a list of swimming holes to go to. But there are others, you know, like that. One that amazed me was the Padre Island National Seashore. If you'd asked me where the longest stretch of public beach in the United States was, I would not have said Texas. I would have thought California or Florida, maybe Washington State, but it's here. It's the Padre Island National Seashore starting there at Corpus Christi, and it's 60 miles of undeveloped, unencroached beach. How long are they going to let that stay like that? I hope forever, but usually they tend to start doing development on those kinds of locations, so... You know, there's a lot of, and then of course, even out in the Big Bend, you know, they're talking about running more pipelines for water, oil, et cetera. And some of these areas, they're going to be affected by it.
Right. And the Balmoray State Park, the San Solomon Spring, the spring in of itself is a very fragile thing. It's, you know, water coming in the middle of the desert, this incredible spring. And there's concern that the fracking that goes on will destroy the geology that brings the water.
Yeah, it's, in my opinion, it's criminal. It's wrong on its face. It is sort of a Texas treasure. And I know, you know, the oil industry is part of our oil and gas industry, part of our heritage. But, you know, can we spare some of these natural treasures now?
The clock is ticking on the Alamo. People may not realize that, but I mean, the Alamo is not going to go away. But that little kind of quaint tourist attraction that's in the middle of downtown San Antonio is getting ready to be totally redesigned. The state has come in. They're going to spend $500 million and to redo Alamo Plaza and everything around it. So I think it would be interesting for people to, if they've never been to Alamo Plaza in this state now, maybe experience that, and then they can come back after the redo and have a comparison.
Yeah, before they turn it into Times Square. I agree with you completely. It's a really neat site, and at first you're shocked that, I mean, you're driving through or you're walking around in the downtown and there's all these tall buildings and you're like, well, where's the Alamo? And then you stumble on it. And I think that's one of the really neat things about it is the modest, you know, appearance and walking up on it.
The plan is to try to give people who come a better understanding of what the Alamo was like during the great battle there, but who knows what they come up with when they finally cut the ribbon on it. I mean, I've been to the state capitol many times working and covering things, but I've never thought to take the tour. What's that tour like?
I haven't done it in a long time, but it's really informative. I had done it a couple times, once when I was younger, a kid on a field trip, and then, I don't know, about 10 years ago, so I did research, updated, you know. Now they have a tour, obviously, of the entire facility, the exterior and the interior. It's just something you should do, something you should see. It's a fantastic building.
The Texas Archive, which is across the street from the Capitol building, have you spent any time there?
Oh, I'm a huge fan of that place. As you know, I did a book called The 1910 Slocum Massacre, an Act of Genocide in East Texas, and that's when I discovered the place. You can go there. The public has access to the papers and files of most of our governors, you know, the legislators. And for instance, when I was researching the Slocum Massacre, you can go in there and you can ask for, you know, archives of the notes of like the governor of the time. His name was Thomas Campbell. And I got files full of notes and correspondences he had with other politicians, telegrams and letters that he had received and instructions he had sent out, and, you know, letters from the Texas Ranger Corps, just different things that you can look up. And I've used that in my research on all of my sort of heavier historical books. It's a real treasure house.
Your book, 100 Things to Do in Texas Before You Die, it's a mix between the natural wonders of the state, some of the man-made wonders of the state, but also some of just the peculiar things about Texas that people should at least get some first contact with, like watching a six-man football game.
You know, it's funny, the editors, when I talked to them about doing this book, they kept stressing I needed to have a lot of football in the book. And I said, well, I'll try to get some in there, but I'm not going to get carried away. You know, they have football everywhere in America, and I know it's a big deal in Texas, but it's a travel book. And so I was kind of not real keen on, you know, visiting stadiums, you know, Jerry World, stuff like that. But six-man football is a different beast. And, you know, a lot of the big-time football programs have boosters, you know, now, and they bring in athletes, and that's kind of disturbing to me. But the small town programs and the six-man football teams, it's still a small town thing. You know, one town against the other, the whole town travels, you know, to the game and supports it, and you know these kids, and it's really still what I would call old time Texas football. So I do recommend that.
So 100 Things to Do in Texas Before You Die. Certainly you don't want to do these things after you die.
And yeah, you better start early.
Start early. And but do you think that this is something that people should be able to get all 100?
Texas is huge, and 100 really isn't enough to cover it. I mean, really, I could have written a tome called 1,000 Things to Do in Texas, but 100, I think, is a manageable list. And But you can't wait, because
E.R. Bills is an author and historian. His latest book is 100 Things to Do in Texas Before You Die. There are lots of words that come to mind in trying to sum up 2018, but getting it down to just one, that's the challenge that many dictionary publishers and editors take on. And when they find that word, what does that word say about us and our time? In her commentary, Texas Public Radio contributor Yvette Benavides tracks the words of the last few years and traces how we got to 2018's dubious selections.
The end of the year means a look at the word of the year from a variety of dictionaries. The top word, presumably, is a metonym for our collective experience of the year's events. Among the dictionaries that publish these lists is the Oxford. The British publisher's word of the year for 2018 is toxic. Data reveals a 45% increase in the number of times people have looked up the word on its website. After debate and careful consideration, words are selected based on how they reflect the ethos, mood, or preoccupations of that particular year and to have lasting potential as a word of cultural significance. It's a figurative finger on the pulse of society to name what's gone on over the last 12 months. And other dictionaries file suit and list their own words of the year after this kind of deliberation and data mining of their own. A quick scan of past words of the year reveals something else. A decade ago, the word of the year was hypermiling, which denotes the collection of driving techniques that improve a car's fuel efficiency. In 2007, the word was locavore, a person whose diet consists of locally grown or produced food. The year before that, in 2006, the term that reflected our preoccupation was carbon neutral, a process of canceling out a carbon footprint. That first decade of the early aughts shows a concerned consumer proactively seeking ways to improve the planet. Just 1 year after we were introduced to hypermiling, the word that reflected the word for our society was unfriend. At the time, I remember being mildly horrified by the word and its place in the year-end roundup. Is this what our world had come to, this bullying coinage born of the damnable bane of human pastime, Facebook? Today, it seems so anemic, and I consider it through a gauzy veil of nostalgia. Refudiate followed that year, a coinage attributed to Sarah Palin to denote a blend of refute and repudiate. While she was largely lampooned for the gaffe, she joins the ranks of those who brought us mashup words like normalcy, brunch, impactful, smog, and motel. We start to see a glimmer of the ways in which just one person in a hissy fit of a tweet storm can bring about change in a language. In the intervening years, equally innocuous terms emerged as resonant with our society. GIF or JIF, selfie, and vaping were number one in 2012, 2013, and 2014, respectively. So those hypermiling locavores moved from concerns of being carbon neutral to something perhaps beyond their proactive control. In 2015, we were on the precipice of something headed our way. That simmering period brought us not a word of the year, but an emoji, the one of a smiley face crying. And that somehow seems appropriate, as it feels like we're all trying to smile through the tears and whistle past the proverbial graveyard just to move through our days when things seem irrevocably broken and, well, toxic. 2016 words of the year from Oxford and Merriam-Webster's were post-truth and surreal, respectively, words that seem more synonymous than not. The Oxford for both the UK and the US also shared the 2017 word, youthquake, the significant cultural, political, or social change arising from the actions or influence of young people. While that word isn't exactly on everyone's lips, the selection was grimly prophetic. Who'd know that only a couple of months later, on Valentine's Day of 2018, the young people of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas in Parkland, Florida, would rock our nation with the power of their conviction to end gun violence after the massacre there that killed 17 classmates and teachers. Our children, some of them too young to vote at the time, started to do the work the rest of us can't seem to manage because of the worst thing that ever happened to them. Youthquake. So now there's a word for what we used to consider unimaginable and nameless. Who'd know indeed that our collective lexicon would move from words like democracy and integrity in 2003 and 2005 to the influence of the dictionary.com word of the year, misinformation, and the related aim of hoaxers to call these children from Parkland crisis actors. Looking ahead, I'd lamentably wager future words of the year to be tender age or climate change or climate change denier. Words matter. That idea gets lost as we live in toxic times when the leader of the country torments reporters and other politicians with schoolyard invectives and whose daily lies are well documented. In gaslighting and other manipulations, words are also used against us and transcend simple denotative communication to larger deceits, no less real for being incredible or absurd or beyond the pale of anything any one of us has experienced before. Language sets us apart from other species. Humans communicate and share information with words. They are the stock in trade, not just of lexicographers, writers, and teachers, but of us all. They are the discrete units of stories. The word of the year, whatever it might be, is somehow imbued with a power to, on its own, tell society's story for a particular year. And it isn't always a very satisfying one. The last few weeks of 2018 won't do much to change the reported resonance of all that is toxic among us or the misinformation that flares out like a wildfire about everything from carbs and keto diets to Kardashians, from climate change to cover-ups and collusion. The poisonous power of fake news takes hold and infects, so much so that out of all the entries in our voluminous lexicon, that's the pair that bubbled up to the top to represent what we're enduring. Toxic misinformation. After January 1st, let's put some unscientific intention and mental muscle behind that required resonance the dictionaries look for. Let's put out lexical vibes born of new mantras. Let's all say things like compassion and equity and justice. Everyone start Googling hope or truth or love or words to that effect.
Texas Public Radio commentator Yvette Benavides is a professor of English and creative writing at Our Lady of the Lake University. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to. And you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.